From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The problems of Africa, the problems of Mozambique, of Kenya, the problems of Latin America started centuries ago. They started with slavery. They started with colonialism. They started with apartheid. Those people, we don't owe them anything. They owe us a life. Away the debt, away.
Thousands rally in Washington yesterday to cancel the debt. We'll bring you excerpts of speeches. And caving to pressure, Starbucks agrees to sell fair trade coffee. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This news from Bolivia. Five people were killed and dozens injured in confrontations across Bolivia as thousands of people protested again the privatization of water, unemployment, and other economic problems. In a town 80 miles north of the capital, La Paz, farmers blocked roads and threw rocks at soldiers who responded with rubber bullets and tear gas. Hundreds of protesters then stormed government offices. Martial law was declared in Bolivia. This news from Charleston, South Carolina. Supporters of the Confederate flag are hoping to keep the stars and bars flying atop the South Carolina State House. Nearly 1,000 people rallied yesterday in Charleston. Their message to lawmakers, keep the Confederate flag up or you'll be ousted in the November election. The Miami relatives of Elian Gonzalez are keeping up their efforts aimed at preventing the boy from returning to Cuba. The family plans to file a brief today in their appeal of a federal judge's ruling last month in the case. The judge ended up siding with the government by affirming the Immigration and Naturalization Service decision to send Elian back to Cuba. A strike by thousands of Southern California janitors might not just leave a mess in the glitzy high-rises of the city's west side and in neighboring Beverly Hills. By October, offices from Seattle to New York could be feeling the effects of a national strategy that traces its roots to a five-year-old negotiation strategy. In Chicago, 125 janitors will begin a hunger strike today to protest the lack of health benefits for suburban janitors whose contract expired yesterday. The city's workers' contract expires this weekend. Machinists at Lockheed Martin's plant in Fort Worth, Texas, are walking the picket line this morning. About 2,300 machinists voted to strike yesterday after negotiations with the defense contractor fell apart. No new talks are scheduled. And this news from Lima. President Alberto Fujimori apparently leads Peru's elections, but it's unclear if he won enough votes to avoid a runoff with his opponents who protested possible fraud with a march. Fujimori received 48.7% support compared with his main rival, Alejandro Toledo's 41%. We're joined on the telephone right now by opposition legislator Javier Diaz-Canseco. He's speaking to us from Lima, Peru. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Well, can you tell us about these election results, which mean Fujimori goes into a runoff election?
Well, the whole electoral process has been quite fraudulent. On first hand, Fujimori had no constitutional right to run for a third term. His postulation for a third term is absolutely illegal. On the second term, he controls the whole electoral system. He controls the national budget and uses it in favor of his campaign. He has hostilized the opponents and the opposition candidates, and he has a strict control over the principal mass media, especially the television stations. All this has brought Peru into a quite fraudulent and obscure electoral process, which finally had its vote yesterday. And then all the polls at first hand gave Mr. Toledo on the lead with around 48% or 48.5% of votes. But after 2 or 3 hours, the polls began to change their position, and they said that Mr. Fujimori was in the lead with around 47.5% or 48%, and Mr. Toledo was around 41%. This provoked a march of Toledo's and opposition supporters last night, quite late in the night, around midnight, to the presidential palace to protest. And obviously, this will should lead to a second round in which the conditions are quite difficult for the opposition and democratic forces because of all the fraudulent conditions that Fujimori established in the election.
Opposition Congress member Javier Diaz-Canseco speaking to us from Lima, Peru, as police used tear gas earlier today to break up a demonstration at the presidential palace led by a candidate who charged that his early lead in national elections was reversed by government fraud. Shouting down with the dictatorship, more than 4,000 protesters were led by Alejandro Toledo. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Oh, Africa, nobody ever apologized for when your blood ran red and your country was stolen by the whites. They took your land and your home and shut you down when you tried to refuse. But I'm sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people, I'm sorry what they did to you. And Africa, nobody ever said it was wrong. Though you cried long and loud in your pain when your life was gone. But no one cared, they took you as slaves and changed your life and your culture too. But I'm sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people, I'm sorry what they did to you.
Tony Bird singing Sorry Africa here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of people yesterday kicked off a week-long series of protests in Washington, D.C., forming a chain around the Capitol and calling for a cancellation of the debt. Before we go to excerpts of those speeches, though, as thousands of protesters were planning to descend on Starbucks throughout the country this Thursday to protest their unfair treatment of coffee growers, the coffee giant has announced it will begin selling fair trade coffee, preempting the scheduled protests led by the human rights group Global Exchange and reacting to the pressure from activists. Starbucks settled sell coffee stamped by the nonprofit group Transfair USA. Medea Benjamin, co-director of Global Exchange, who's running for the U.S. Senate against Dianne Feinstein in California, was in New York this weekend for major anti-sweatshop conference, and she explained the significance of Starbucks' move.
Well, in a major concession to the protest movement against Starbucks selling sweatshop coffee, Starbucks has just announced that they will buy fair trade certified coffee and make it available in all of their over 2,000 stores as a choice for consumers.
What do you mean by fair trade coffee?
Well, there is an organization called Transfair, started in Europe and has in the last year come to the United States, that certifies coffee as fair trade, which means that the farmers are guaranteed $1.26 a pound, which would be the equivalent of a living wage for farmers. Takes out the intermediary, and it also guarantees low-income credit, and many other benefits for farmers. And then there is a monitoring system set up to make sure that these are really taking place on the ground. So you get a coffee, if you buy whole beans, for example, in the package that you get, there will be a label, the Transfair label, guaranteeing that that's fair trade coffee.
And where will this coffee come from?
This coffee comes from all over. A lot of it is coming from Central America. A lot of it comes from Mexico, from the Oaxaca region. There's about 200,000 farmers that participate in this fair trade coffee. This is the largest purchase of fair trade coffee ever in the United States.
What about the vast majority of the coffee Starbucks sells? What do you mean by its sweatshop coffee?
Well, the coffee that is not fair trade certified, we have no way of knowing what the conditions are for farmers, and the conditions tend to be very bad. Either they are getting low wages working on plantations, or if they are individual coffee farmers, they tend to get about 40 cents a pound for their coffee. When it's fair trade certified, you're buying from small farmers, which is also ecologically positive because they're not using the kind of massive pesticides you use on the plantations, and they're guaranteed $1.26 a pound.
You think Seattle had an influence on Starbucks, where it's based?
Tremendous. I think Seattle had an influence. I think all the switch up campaigns had an influence. I think the most important thing was that Global Exchange on April 13th was launching a national campaign against Starbucks. We had 25 cities already set up across the country. We were all excited, and people are excited in this campaign, and Starbucks kept getting all the materials, seeing how big this movement was getting against them, and they capitulated before we even had our first massive demonstrations.
Will this be coffee you can get in the stores, or is it the bagged coffee?
This is the bagged coffee, and we are pushing them to also make it brewed coffee. But I should say that we negotiated with Starbucks for a long time, pushing them to buy the fair trade coffee. It wasn't until post-Seattle, going to their shareholder meeting about 6 weeks ago and shaming them in front of 1,500 shareholders and organizing these massive protests for April 13th, that they finally capitulated.
How did you shame them?
Oh, stood up in front of their shareholders and said, if you don't buy fair trade coffee soon, you will become known, as Nike has, as the purveyors, in this case, of sweatshop coffee.
Medea Benjamin, a co-director of Global Exchange, running for the U.S. Senate in California. Again, Starbucks has agreed to buy some fair trade coffee. It will be labeled Trans Fair, a seal on bags of coffee, but it's not yet the brewed coffee that is served around the country in Starbucks stores. Well, as protesters prepare to shut down the annual meetings of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank next Sunday and Monday, when finance ministers from around the world will converge in Washington, thousands of activists rallied yesterday in Washington to demand debt relief for the world's poorest countries. The rally, sponsored by the faith-based organization Jubilee 2000, was aimed at pressuring the Congress to approve $210 million to fund an initiative that would cut the debts of the world's poorest nations. It ended with the formation of a human chain around Congress, symbolizing the chains of debt. Yesterday's event kicked off the series of planned protests. On Wednesday, union leaders are planning a massive rally on Congress to oppose permanent trade relations with China and China entering the World Trade Organization. John Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO, who just returned from the International Trade Union meeting in Durban, South Africa, was one of those who spoke.
Brothers and sisters, it's my privilege to come before you today and bring a message from the 40 million men and women and children living in union households all across the United States. Our message is clear. Today's unions and the working families of America want debt relief, and we want debt relief now. It is also my privilege to bring you news from the World Congress of the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, which met last week in Durban, South Africa, from which I returned yesterday. The ICFTU member unions from 145 countries voted unanimously to call for a far-reaching solution to the crushing burden of debt borne by developing countries. The news from Durban is clear. The ICFTU, and indeed the working families of the world, demand debt relief, and we demand debt relief now. In South Africa, just as in Seattle, it was painfully clear from the stories I heard over and over again, that we are bound by conscience and conviction to move on debt relief with great speed. In Mozambique, one out of four children dies before reaching the age of five. One out of four young children dies because of infectious diseases that can be controlled. But the government of Mozambique is spending twice as much on servicing international debt as it spends on health and education combined. In Ethiopia, more than 100,000 children die every year from diarrhea that can be treated and prevented. But the government of Ethiopia is spending four times as much on debt payments as its public budget for health care. In Uganda, where one in five children also dies from a treatable, preventable disease before age five, the government is spending $17 per person on repaying its debt while spending only $3 per person on health care. If nothing else, the debt burden of developing countries is killing hundreds of thousands of children every year. And that's why, my sisters and brothers, we can't wait until next year or the next year. And that's why we are united, united in our mission and committed to the goal of debt relief now. But sadly, the crushing burden of worldwide debt is doing even more than killing children. It's also killing the hopes and the dreams of working families from Managua to Milwaukee, from Karachi to Kansas City. High debt levels force developing countries to lower labor standards and wages in order to attract corporate investment. That means American workers must compete for jobs with other workers in other countries who are making 10 cents an hour. It pits worker against worker and nation against nation in a race to the bottom. And it's a race we must stop with debt relief now. Brothers and sisters, I believe if we work hard enough and march long enough and press our elected officials hard enough, we can persuade the United States government and our Congress to support worldwide debt relief for countries that are committed to democratic reforms and core workers' rights. The amount of money it would cost this country is an incredibly small portion of our budget, yet the amount of help and leadership it would provide would be unbelievably large. But debt relief alone won't make the global economy work for working families. Rich countries, especially the United States, must provide more funds to poor countries for economic development. We must make sure the money goes to creating more jobs, providing better health care, raising more food, and building more schools, and not to building more palaces or buying more tanks. Technologically advanced countries, especially the United States, must provide more assistance to developing nations while insisting that the governments that receive our assistance respect basic human rights and workers' rights in their fields and in their factories. And progressive, politically powerful countries, most especially the United States, must insist that international financial institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank stop pressuring countries to reform their economies in the wrong direction and instead reform themselves. As I told the delegates in Durban, South Africa, we must demand a world economy that allows nations to follow different paths to development, even as it enforces standards and core values common to us all. Together, people of faith and conscience can rescue the world economy from those who know the price of everything and the value of nothing. Together, we can build a world where children stretch their minds in classrooms instead of straining their backs in factories. A world where every man and woman can live and work in dignity, where markets lift us up instead of driving us down. That world begins with debt relief. Debt relief now. Thank you and God bless you all.
John Sweeney, the president of the AFL-CIO, speaking yesterday to thousands of protesters in Washington, D.C. on a very windy day with snow in the morning, to say the least, unseasonal. When we come back, we'll be hearing from a South African speaker as well as from a woman from Mozambique. And in our last segment, we'll hear the story of a young basketball player, high school, in San Antonio, Texas, who, after elbowing a rival player on the court, was charged with aggravated assault and sits in a jail facing 5 years in prison. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Again, we continue with yesterday's major rally against the debt, calling for cancellation of the debt for poor countries. Thousands of people gathered in Washington, D.C., and among those who spoke was Trevor Ngwame, who is with Jubilee 2000, South Africa campaign.
Viva Jubilee 2000, viva! Viva Jubilee 2000, viva!
Viva!
Away with the debt, away! Down with sexual adjustment, down! I also want to thank the people of America, the people of Bolivia, the people of Latin America, all those people who were with us when we were fighting against apartheid. Today, we have destroyed apartheid. Today, I can stand here, talk freely, not scared of going back home. Thank you. But my message today is that our job is not finished. Apartheid is dead, but economic exploitation and injustice continues. The government of the ANC, the new boy in the block, has decided to join the big guys and is now following neoliberal economic policies. South Africa is being used as a launching pad to perpetuate neoliberal policies in Africa. This is why you are here. We want your support. We had wanted Mandela to lead the struggle against the debt. He has not done so. Away with the debt, away! Now, yesterday, Jubilee 2000, we were appealing, asking for forgiveness, saying, World Bank, IMF, forgive us our sins. Please, don't make us pay the debt. But now we have moved. We are now demanding the cancellation of the debt. But moreover, we are beginning to ask the question, who owes what to whom? The problems of Africa, the problems of Mozambique, of Kenya, the problems of Latin America started centuries ago. They started with slavery. They started with colonialism. They started with apartheid. Those people, we don't owe them anything. They owe us a life. They destroyed our countries. They took our brothers and sisters, put them in slave ships, brought them here. Now they are knifing us back at home in Africa. Away with the debt, away. Now, we are saying here, yeah, because we know the World Bank and the IMF, this is their capital city. We in South Africa are launching a campaign to boycott World Bank bonds because we want to stop the World Bank from spreading its neoliberal economic policies. We are calling for your support in this campaign to boycott the bonds which are issued by the World Bank. Away with buying World Bank bonds, away! We are saying to American companies, those companies who joined us when we were fighting apartheid and disinvested, now the time has come to disinvest from the World Bank. Stop buying World Bank bonds, stop! Down with special adjustment, down! The other thing, comrades, is that it is no use to only call for the cancellation of debt when the World Bank and IMF continue to feed us the medicine of neoliberal structural adjustment policies. Those policies are killing our people. Already in South Africa, clinics, hospitals, schools are being closed down because the World Bank and the IMF are saying you are spending too much money on the poor. Already our water, our roads is being privatized because of the policies of the World Bank and the IMF. So let us join hands now and unite in struggle across the globe in our battle against the World Bank. Away with the World Bank, away! Away with the apartheid debt, away! Today in South Africa, in our budget, our government is spending 48 billion rands servicing the debt. But you know where this debt comes from? This is the money which was borrowed by apartheid to buy guns and bullets to kill us. Today we are being made to pay twice for apartheid. We paid for apartheid with our blood. We paid with our lives. Today, we are paying the debts of apartheid. Away with paying the apartheid debt, away! This is the situation faced by our brothers in Mozambique. You all know that in Mozambique, we had floods. A lot of things were destroyed in Mozambique. But the World Bank is saying they're going to lend Mozambique more money to help them. How can you lend Mozambique more money to get them out of a crisis? Already Mozambique is paying $1 million every week to service the debt. Away with making Mozambique get a loan to get out of the flood. Away!
Away!
The last thing I want to say is in Bolivia, yesterday, in Bolivia, martial law was declared. Our comrades are in jail. The country is up in arms because the people are against privatization. We must stand united against what is happening in Bolivia. Thank you very much. Away with the World Bank, away! Viva Jubilee 2000, viva! Forward with the struggle against neoliberal economics, forward! Thank you.
Great.
Trevor Ngwame from the Jubilee 2000 South Africa campaign speaking on a very windy and snowy day yesterday in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move now to another speaker at the rally of thousands calling for cancellation of the debt to the poorest countries of the world, Salame Mayone, Mozambican member of parliament, hundreds killed and an estimated 1 million people displaced after floods ravaged the South African country earlier this year.
Before the natural disaster that we had in Mozambique in February this year, we were already among one of the poorest countries in the world. Out of 1,000 children born, 240 die before reaching 5 years of life. We also have a very little expenses rate that is 45%, and more or less 40% of our population can't read or write. What means, among other things, that more than 70% of our population is living in absolute poverty. Mozambique has, since 1989, carrying out what we call structural adjustments on the framework of IMF as well as the World Bank. The main goal of this program has been curbing inflation and creating a balance between imports and exports in the country. The program, however, have not managed to establish a link between economic growth as well as the reduction of absolute poverty. Most of the Mozambicans, as I said, nearly 70% are living in absolute poverty, and is this the majority of people living in the countryside that were the most victim of floods? I would like to go again to the problem of debt. Since the Mozambican Debt Group was founded, we have appealed for a total cancellation of our debt, and that the money should be used for long-term development within social areas, particularly education and health. So that's why the signal that is here is very clear for us. So say with us, cancel the debt now! Cancel the debt now. Dear friends, this appeal becomes even more urgent today after the massive destruction of the floods and the cyclone Eline that affected thousands in Mozambique. The Mozambican Debt Group believes that emergency aid and funds needed for long-term development should at no point compete with each other. It isn't acceptable that the foreign funds that were allocated to finance long-term development projects has been used to resolve emergency situations. Those are two very different. This creates a self-threat of economic backlash. The same situation occurs with national funds. Because the government has to shift priorities in the public budget from long-term development for emergency assistance. We estimate that we will need between $207 and $430 million to recuperate from the floods. Just to give some example, because of the problem of the flood, the health sector will need great resources during the next month to avoid the outbreak of malaria as well as cholera already killing our children at home. Many health posts and hospitals have been destroyed. The cost for reconstruction of this area will be $20 million. That is the same amount of money that we need for a year for just primary health care for our people. Dear friends, although there has been a response from the international community and from multilateral institutions to our appeal for a total debt cancellation. We are very disappointed because the decision made by the Paris Club and the World Bank. The World Bank decided to give Mozambique a one-year moratorium on the debt service. It doesn't mean that the debt was cancelled, and it doesn't mean either that the interest rates are not to be paid. The Paris Club response was similar. We reiterate our appeal for the total cancellation of our external debt. Allow me to add, dear friends, in this moment in Mozambique, there are two problems. It's our appeal to cancel the total debt of our country. Secondly, at the same time, to help us save lives, to help us rebuild Mozambique, to help us reintegrate our population and also bringing a better future for our children at home. Thank you very much, and we thank your solidarity. Thanks. Long live solidarity!
Salome Maione, she is a Mozambican member of parliament, speaking in Washington, D.C. yesterday at the rally sponsored by Jubilee 2000, where thousands gathered to call for the cancellation of the debt. And finally, we go to Ricardo Navarro, head of Friends of the Earth International from El Salvador and winner of the Goldman Environmental Prize.
Brothers and sisters, it is really nice to be here. It is nice that to see that a lot of people are united for one cause, to cancel the debt. Now we are in the year of the jubileum. According to the biblical tradition, in that year we had to compensate for all the things that had gone wrong. There are several things that are wrong now with our society. Starting with poverty. Half of the people in the world don't have enough to eat. Half of the people in the world don't have access to safe water. Most of them in the southern hemisphere. And those things have to stop. In Africa, Asia, and Latin America, poverty generates violence. All the debt that cannot be paid also generates the destruction of the environment. Here, I represent Friends of the Earth International. We have to remember that the World Bank and the IMF, they have also supported criminal regimes in the third world. They also share the criminal responsibility. They supported Pinochet. They supported the criminal governments in Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, many African countries, also Asia. Criminal people should be punished. I was reading that some people here in Washington were worried about the violence that we may cause here. We are peaceful people. We are for the welfare of the people. We are for defending the environment. They should worry for the violence that the World Bank is generating and has generated throughout the world. Many countries in the Southern Hemisphere are very vulnerable. We have destroyed our resources to pay the debt. What happens when a Hurricane Mitch comes to Central America? 12,000 people were killed. What happened in Venezuela last December? 15,000 people were killed. What happened in Mozambique a few weeks ago? 1 million people affected. All that, why? Because all our resources have to be put to pay the debt. To pay the debt is a crime. What the World Bank and the IMF want to do is a crime. And we should not allow this crime to happen.
Ricardo Navarro, head of Friends of the Earth International from El Salvador, winner of the Goldman Environmental Prize, the Nobel equivalent for environmental activists. Yes, speaking yesterday at a protest of thousands in Washington, D.C., the beginning of a week period of activities, protests, and rallies, culminating next week on Sunday with the attempt of protesters coming from around the country and the world to close down the annual meeting of the International Monetary Fund, and Monday to close down the annual meeting of the World Bank. Democracy Now! Will bring you the issues and the people who are in Washington for these protests throughout the week. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. When we come back, you're going to hear the story of an 18-year-old high school senior playing basketball. His foul drew a jail term. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, this is how the New York Times put it just a few weeks ago with the headline, "Basketball Player's Foul Draws a Jail Term." They said, just over a year ago, 18-year-old Tony Lamon was a proud senior starter for the Bobcats, the South San Antonio High School basketball team, weighing the offer of a college basketball scholarship. Today, he sits in a Bexar County jail cell waiting for a decision whether a judge will reduce his 5-year prison sentence for assault. 14 months ago, Lamon threw an elbow into an opponent's face in a basketball game, breaking the player's nose. The severity of the sentence for Tony has surprised many involved in school sports. The incident took place in January of 99 in a game between South San and East Central High School of San Antonio. A videotape shows Lamon striking Brent Holmes, an East Central guard, late in the first half, and Holmes' head snapping backward before he fell to the floor. Brent Holmes is now a college student who plays football and baseball. And again, Tony Lamon sits in a county jail. We're joined right now by Tony's mother, Olivia Lamon, speaking to us from San Antonio, as well as her lawyer, Carlos Uresti. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Olivia Lamon, why don't we talk about what happened that night and how Tony ended up in jail?
Well, it was just a regular game as usual. It was heated up as usual, but, you know, it happened, and he's apologized on numerous occasions, and so have I. And 6 months after that, we were informed that there had been a warrant for his arrest on that incident.
6 months later.
Yes, ma'am. And thereafter, you know, it's just been going to court back and forth. And on February 7th, the judge charged him. And they took him away from me.
Is Tony your only son?
Yes, he is.
Olivia Lamon, I'll give you a minute to collect yourself, and I know how hard this is for you. You get to see your son in the county jail, but it's not where you expected to visit him. Carlos Aresti is the Limón family lawyer. Can you explain how he drew such a serious sentence? I mean, I'm looking at this article where you have people like Alton Ballard, executive director of the Texas Association of Basketball Coaches, who said in his 25 years with the association, quote, "We've never seen a high school student or a college student charged for something they did during a sporting event."
Good morning, Amy. I guess we have to look kind of at the timeline involved. And I think part of the problem or one of the factors that's involved is the fact that Tony was on probation, deferred adjudication, which means there was no conviction, for an attempted burglary charge that occurred about 25 days before the basketball game. Now, he was placed on deferred adjudication, meaning basically judge says, look, Tony, you know, stay out of trouble. I'm going to put you on probation. At the end of the probationary period, if you don't mess up, the case will be dismissed, therefore no conviction. Tony had been on probation for about a year at the time of the sentencing for the assault case. And I'm not sure what the judge was considering, but it's apparent from the record that he took into consideration the fact that Tony was on probation for the attempted burglary, although it was not a felony conviction at that time. And perhaps, and of course, this is just in my personal opinion, that's what influenced the judge's decision. I would agree with, from my perspective, and being an attorney for about almost 10 years, I've never seen a situation like this in those 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Olivia Limón, Tony says that his coach and other kids apparently heard this, said that at that point in the game, what does he quote him saying? It's about time someone drew some blood. Is this the case?
If the people that were there state that they heard him, we do have witnesses that did hear that statement.
Did Tony bring this up that night? I mean, some coaches do that. They say play rough. Did Tony raise this with the authorities, that he was following the orders of his coach?
Tony looked at Derb as a father figure. There was nothing that Derb would tell Tony to do that Tony would not do.
The coach's name is Gary Durbin.
Yes. Tony was very close to Gary, and he was, like I said, Tony regarded Derb as a father figure. And yes, Tony had told me on numerous occasions of all this roughness going on and what he was instructed to do and not to do. So I was aware of the situation, but I'm sure most coaches or some of them have the same tactics. So to me, you know, Tony himself had been a victim of having been elbowed in the face and been sent to the hospital with a head concussion a couple of months before or so. And, you know, to me, it's just a physical contact game, and just take him to the hospital, get him taken care of, and just get back on the game, you know?
In the New York Times piece, two of Tony's other players, Ray Pacheco, said he remembered clearly what happened when the players returned to the huddle after Holmes was hurt. The coach told Tony, "It's about time someone drew some blood." Pacheco said that's exactly what he said to him. And the other one, Richard Gonzalez, said, "Yeah, coach said it. He always encouraged people to play real tough, to play real physical." So when it came time for the trial, which wasn't before a jury, is that right? Just the judge decided?
That's correct.
Was that weighed?
No, it wasn't. Nothing of that was brought up.
Has the coach, Durbin, stepped forward?
No, he hasn't. In fact, he's denied everything.
I should say, yeah, actually, he's quoted as saying he just made a mistake that night and went a little too far talking about Tony. He said, "I don't think Tony really intended to hurt anyone." We are hoping to get a call from either the coach or the coach's lawyer, but I don't know if we will. They said if they agreed to come on, they would just give us a call. So right now, where is Tony Limón, your son?
In jail.
Where?
Bexar County.
And
as far as I know.
Do you get to see him?
I get to see him during the week for 15 minutes.
Once a week for 15 minutes?
No, they allow you. It goes up alphabetically. So his because of his last name, I can visit Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Mm-hmm. So.
And what are you waiting for the judge to decide right now, the judge Mark Luchin?
I think that question will go to Carlos.
Carlos Aresti.
I can answer that, Amy. We have filed a motion for shock probation.
For shock probation?
Correct.
What is that?
And actually, we have filed a couple of documents, but one of the documents we filed is called a motion for shock probation. The judge still has jurisdiction over this case. He has 180 days from the date of sentencing, which was February the 7th, in which to grant Tony shock probation. What that means, in essence, is Tony is sent off to jail and eventually to prison. And within 180 days, the judge can basically reach into prison, pull him back, and say, okay, Tony, you've been shocked, hence the term shock probation. You don't want to go to prison. I'm going to place you on probation for the remainder of the 5 years. And so long as you keep your nose clean, you stay out of trouble, et cetera, you stay out of prison. Now, the felony conviction will remain. So that's one of the options that's available to Tony. We filed that motion this past Friday. We went in, Mr. McGinnis, my co-counsel, and I went in and spoke with the judge and filed the motion, and it's under consideration. The judge has less than 4 months remaining in which to decide whether or not he's going to grant the shock probation. We have also filed initially within a couple of weeks of the sentencing, we filed a motion for new trial, which was denied by the judge. And we have requested permission to appeal the judge's decision. That was denied. And we will be filing within the next couple of days our notice of appeal to the Fourth Court of Appeals.
Olivia Limon, what were Tony's plans before this?
He wanted to be a veterinarian, and he had told me, like, I'm not going to go to college right after school. You realize he graduated when he was 17, and he goes, Mom, I have a whole year, so I'm going to go ahead and work, and once this is cleared up, Mom, you know, I'll go to college. That way I don't have to be taken off to go to court and all this other stuff, right? Doing restitution and all this other stuff on the other incident. I'd like to touch base with Carlos on that because it sounded to me when he talked that he said that when Tony was sentenced, he was on probation. Well, Tony was not on probation when he was sentenced. I don't know if he realized that he came across that way or not, Carlos.
He was on probation at the time he was sentenced. He wasn't on probation at the time he was arrested at the time of the basketball game.
Right, and that a lot of people are under the impression that he was on probation when he did the foul, and that's not so at all. He didn't go into probation until March. See, the burglary, attempted burglary by association happened in December. Then in January, the basketball incident. And we didn't even go to court till March on that first incident.
Huh.
So, like, to us, and for all we knew, you know, like, everything was okay, you know. We didn't even know. We thought it had already stopped at that point, you know.
Olivia Limon, do you have any other kids?
I have a daughter.
How old is she?
She's 22.
How has this affected her?
My daughter has been very strong. She's a very religious person, and that has really helped her through all this. You know, but it's her only brother, as we all realize, and you know, it has taken a toll on her, but praise the Lord that, you know, because of him, you know, she's hanging in there, and now at this point, even Tony has converted. He's become a born-again Christian, and he's even baptized himself in jail, and he's just made a 90-degree turn, and he's walking on faith pretty much, you know. And he's just a completely different person. Not that he was a bad person before, but now he belongs to the Lord, and that's the best that could happen to Tony or to anybody, in my way of thinking.
I'm looking at the photograph of him in the New York Times, and he's shackled both his hands and his feet in the interview. Tony Limon faces a 5-year prison term. We've been speaking with his mother, Olivia Limon, and his lawyer, Carlos Aresti. And I want to thank you both for being with us. Carlos Aresti, also a Texas state representative. We're going to go now to Henry Rodriguez, who is the chapter director for the League of United Latin American Citizens, known as LULAC, which is a civil rights group. And this group held a news conference denouncing the sentence by the judge as cruel and unfair, saying that if this had taken place in a white community instead of a Hispanic community, that this sentence would not have been imposed. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Henry Rodriguez.
Thank you very much.
We only have a few minutes, but can you tell us the gist of your denunciation of the judge's sentence?
Well, like anybody else, we feel like this is unprecedented and really uncalled for. This is not justice. This is a young man that has a whole life ahead of him. He's a good kid, basically, like most kids. They're not angels. But in a case like this, no one has ever been convicted of this kind of crime. Why Tony? And it is very upsetting. And we try to cooperate with everyone and try to see every angle. But yet, everything points out that this is not justice at all. I don't know what else we can say.
What are you doing at this point?
At this point in time, we're waiting to see what happens. If he's gonna, are they gonna set a bond on him so we can help out with that? We are starting a legal fund for him. We want to help in every possible way, cooperate with everyone. But you know, we do feel rather helpless because of the fact that he's been in jail all this time. As a matter of fact, he's gone through enough already, and so has his mother. And we just want to have a wait and see opinion right now, where we'll just play it by ear. But we will collectively as an organization support him in every which way that we possibly can.
Now, your press release was denounced by Tony's lawyers. Why?
I can understand that. And my only reasoning for that, or my only thinking about that, is that the lawyers have to go before the judges all the time. They cannot be bad-mouthing a judge. We don't. And we know that this will not affect the relationship that the judge and the judge have, that the attorneys and the judge have, in any way, shape, or form. This is our opinion and our opinion only. Anytime any case is in litigation, we won't do anything to hurt the case. And but of course, we can. I know that an attorney is not going to badmouth the judge. There's no way in the world that he has to go before him all the time.
If people want to get in touch with LULAC, with your organization, the League of United Latin American Citizens, where can they call in San Antonio?
They can call area code 210, and the number is 731-9195. Or they can even call me on my cell phone. It's 286-5383.
That's 210-286-5383. And I want to thank you very much for being with us. Sound a little difficult because you are on your cell phone, but Henry Rodriguez, chapter director of the League of United Latin American Citizens.
I'm on my funeral procession right now, as a matter of fact.
A funeral procession for who?
Yes, a friend of mine that died.
Oh, well, I'm sorry, and thanks for being with us.
But we're there for Tony, and we have so many things to say, but, you know, in an instance like this, when you have little time, you know, all we can say is that we'll do every possible thing that we can for Tony. If we have to, down the road, do some demonstrations or whatever, we have to. That's what we'll do. But right now, we're just going to stay calm and see what happens.
Henry Rodriguez, thanks for being with us again. Tony Limon, he was 18 years old, a senior starter for the Bobcats of the South San Antonio High School, elbowed another player and got a sentence of 5 years in prison for aggravated assault. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion, David Love, and Deepa Fernandez. Special thanks to Rosalie Hoffman and Robert Knight. Democracy Now! Is engineered by Matthew Finch. Errol Maitland is recuperating at home, our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and you can reach us at democracy@pacifica.org. Thanks for listening.